Welcome to episode 234 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today, we're going to be finding out about driving to the Alps in an electric vehicle, about Courmayeur in Italy. Plus, we have an entrepreneur focus, as I'm joined by two people today who have both set up snow sports companies, and we're going to find out how they did it. We also have our regular snow reports, your feedback, news on more World Cup wins for Team GB, plus an update from Dave Riding ahead of the World Championships in Saalbach. Now, my name's Ian Martin. I'd like to introduce my guest today. Firstly, I'd like to welcome Erin Flynn. She is founder of the clothing company Ruanua. Hi, Erin. How are you today?
Hi, Ian. How are you? I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on today.
It's a pleasure. Whereabouts are you?
I'm in London. I'm at home.
Okay. And just taking something from your accent there and what you told me in the green room earlier about Ruanua, that's not your original home, right?
No, I'm from Dublin in Ireland.
Okay, excellent. Well, we'll come back to the company Ruanua in due course. My second guest today is Simon Hooper. He's the founder of White Storm, the ski hire company in Courchevel and Merivale. Hi, Simon. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And whereabouts are you?
I'm in a small village called Le Grenier at about 1,000 metres just below Courchevel.
Okay, and I was looking on the webcams earlier for Courchevel up at Salier, and I couldn't see anything because it looks like there's a whiteout. I'm guessing it's snowing today. Any snow out the window?
Yeah, so it snowed last night to about 1,800 metres, and it's been snow raining to about 1,600 early this morning, and now it's snowing to 1,300, and we've got a lot of snow forecast next week, which is fantastic.
That is really good. I'm always paying attention to the forecast. And I have seen there's more coming in. So top-ups are always good. We'll come on to snow reports in due course. But a question I do like to ask my guests to start off with is, when did you ski or snowboard last? And I'll start with you, Erin. When were you last on the snow?
So I was last on the snow in the end of November, start of December. I went to Trevinia and the snow was perfect. We had snow the first day and then bluebirds for the rest of the time. But I'm actually going to Les Deux Alpes, which I think is one of your favourites, next week, and I've never been, so I'm really excited.
When you went to Trevinia, you're going in November. Presumably at that point you were skiing on the glacier linked over with Zermatt at that time.
Yeah, we were, exactly. But the snow was actually starting to go pretty low, so we weren't able to ski to the village, but nearly. And yeah, it's amazing. You can ski over the Zermatt side and the Trevinia side, and it was just, the conditions were incredible.
And you're right about Les Deux Alpes. If you've been listening to the podcast, and regular listeners will know, she went there twice last winter. And we recently had Catherine Murphy on the show in the last one episode, 232, telling us about the new Gendry 3S lift, which is amazing. And I'm sure you'll enjoy that when you go out there.
Yeah, I was very excited listening to that episode.
Excellent. And Simon, what about yourself? You live in a ski resort, but you run a business. How often do you get on the snow? When are you last out there?
Oh, I went most of the day yesterday. Skied Le Mas yesterday, which got that amazing viewing platform you've probably been on. Skied Mont Valon yesterday as well, and then had a lovely lunch in Saint-Martin de Belleville.
Getting the most out of the three valleys. You're over there in Les Menuires and Merivale, even though you're based in Courchevel.
Well, sometimes it's nice to get out of Courchevel. I've got some friends staying at the moment, and when I have friends staying, it's always nice for them to take me out to lunch.
Excellent. And just tell me, so, you know, you skied all three valleys of Les Trois Vallées yesterday. How did you find the snow?
So the snow is pretty good, considering we haven't had a real much snowfall in the last 10 days, but it's been really cold and sunny as well, which means the piece is actually holding up quite well because it's been cold at night, so they've been canning a lot. And even the run down to Saint-Martin de Belleville, which I think is about 1,100 or 1,200 maybe, was still pretty good. I mean, there are so many cannons in the three valleys now that as long as it's cold, they can pump some snow out.
Now, that's really interesting to hear about Courchevel. I was actually skiing last weekend in Chamonix and prior to that in Courmayeur. Chamonix, I really enjoyed it there. I was only in Le Tour for a day, but the snow was in really good condition. It was kind of hard packed on piste. You wouldn't want to be skiing off piste in any way at all. In Courmayeur, it was more granulated. It was a bit more of that snow cannon generated snow, but the cover was good. You're not skiing down into resort 1300 in Courmayeur, but higher up it was good. And what really struck me about Courmayeur in particular is it was empty. Those slopes were so empty, and I was skiing with a good friend of mine, and just one of those opportunities where you could really open up and go fast. You've got a beautifully corduroy pasted slope in front of you and no one on it. I had a good pair of skis from the hire shop and I absolutely love that. But we have a couple of other snow reports. We've got Mike Richards. He's currently out in Turkey. He's going to report on that. And Floss, regular contributor, tells us how conditions are in team.
Good morning, Ian. It's Mike the Snow Richards reporting in from Erzurum Ski Resort in the central Anatolia region of Turkey. I'm in the very privileged position to be accompanying ski legend Dan Egan, his nephew Johnny, and their crew of filmmakers as they recreate Dan's iconic visit back in the early 90s, where he and his brother John skied Erzurum at the Fairy Chimneys of the UNESCO Heritage Site of Cappadocia. The first 2 days of skiing at Erzurum have been challenging with freeze-thaw conditions and firm snow off-piste, but it's been a revelation to see how Dan and Johnny cope with the conditions and bring home epic footage and images. They're not the talent for nothing. We woke to 5 centimetres overnight Wednesday and it snowed all day today and tonight. The 120 kilometres of piste will be in excellent shape under sunny skies, and hopefully Friday we'll enjoy bluebird powder turns at Erzurum. Unfortunately, during our time in Turkey, Kartalkaya Resort between Istanbul and Ankara suffered the terrible tragedy of the hotel fire which took so many lives. Our thoughts and condolences go out to all those affected, but it's important to stress that this was an isolated incident and the ski resorts of Turkey are safe and ready to welcome all snow enthusiasts. That's me checking out. I'll report back once we've had those powder turns.
Hi, this is Floss from Free Flow Ski, bringing you the weather report from Tiene and Val d'Isère. Now, this week has been out of peak season and the pistes have been quieter and spacious. We're looking forward to another quiet week this week before we get into the February busy holidays. Now, I'm happy to say that 159 out of 167 pistes have been open and are in good condition. Now, temperatures have been really stable between -4 and -9 at 2,500. We have been so lucky, right? We've had 10 days of back-to-back bluebird sunshine, and now we're looking forward to a top-up of fresh snow starting from Wednesday evening with more snow arriving Sunday and into next week. Now, despite the bluebird days, we've had a lot of wind affecting the off-piste above 2,200. It has been really difficult to ski on as there's wind slab and inconsistent layers in the snowpack. Just wanted to say, wishing you all a very happy sliding from Free Flow Floss in Tiene.
Don't forget, if you want to help the Ski Podcast and save yourself some money this winter, all you need to do is use the code SKIPODCAST when you book your ski hire at intersportrent.com. And that applies to any ski hire booked in their large network across France, Austria and Switzerland. That's hundreds of resorts. You'll get a guaranteed additional discount, or simply take the link in the show notes for your discount to be automatically applied. Now, I have some news on Team GB. I mentioned this at the top of the show. Mia Brooks, you might have seen her recently on Ski Sunday. She took a win in Lax in the slopestyle last week. That is her fourth consecutive podium, her third win of the season. And that was actually the day before her 18th birthday. I've seen her on the podium before, swinging away from the champagne that she has won. This time she'll be able to do it legally. Jasmine Taylor, a friend of the show, she's been on several times before. She is a telemarker. She picked up a first and a second in the most recent races. She is now first overall after four races, and she is defending her Crystal Globe. And Dave Riding was in town. He was in the UK recently, just talking about the World Championships. And so let's have a listen to what he had to say about that.
Yeah, feeling decent, to be honest, feeling in pretty good physical shape, with the body and everything, the mind, and just continually working to make sure that I'm in the right place. Well, every race really, but yeah, particularly come February. Yeah, I mean, I always love seeing a British flag, and something that I've noticed, like since I started the World Cup and started getting top 30s, you'd maybe see the odd flag. Now, say even in Kitzbühel, Sladming, these bigger races, there's a lot of British flags, which is really, really cool to see. And it's nice. You know, it stands out so well, the Union Jack, that, yeah, it just gives you that extra sense of pride that you're representing. And these people have come to watch you and your teammates. So, yeah, it's an honor to have people travel and spend their money to come and watch you race. And yeah, I've very much enjoyed trying to do my best for them over the years. And obviously the year that I won was COVID, but there were still some British fans in the crowd. I don't know how the hell they got the tickets, because there was only maybe 600 people. But yeah, it's really nice to see. And the British skiing is full of passion and full of, yeah, people love it. So when you know the people who are coming really, really are there because they love skiing, ski racing and Brits. Yeah, it'll be a really big crowd. It'll be really fun to compete there. And hopefully I'll feed off that. I've really learned that over the years, I've learned to use the energy from the crowd. So when there is a big crowd, I really enjoy it. I really like it. So yeah, hopefully that's the case in Saalbach. I say to everyone, like since the last Olympics, I honestly didn't think I'd be in a position to be able to compete. I only want to go to another Olympics to compete or to do the best result I've ever done at an Olympic Games. I don't want to go just to say I've been to five Olympics. It interests me not at all. Like after the last Olympics, I decided I'm going to focus on a short-term basis, because if I tried to focus on a four-year cycle, I thought I was going to pace myself. So I've really enjoyed going all in each year and then evaluating where I'm at the end of the year. And yeah, that's how I've managed to sort of thrive after the Olympics as well, because once I think, right, I'm going to go again, and spoken to my sponsors and my wife, etc., to do it, then I commit all in. And I know that it's for a 12-month period, not a four-year period. So I can get my head around that. And I know that if I'm good like now, then there's a good chance that if I do all the training and get my body in the right shape, that I'll be good in another 6 to 12 months time. So I just love focusing on the now and taking each race as it comes, trying to enjoy each venue every time I go there, and that's working. So but personally, I just want to finish this year, do as well as I can this year, and then I'll turn my attention to the Olympic Games.
Okay, well, regular listeners will recall I took the Flight Free UK pledge in 2024, and I'm pleased to say I'm going to be doing that in 2025. And it doesn't mean that I'm never going to fly again. What I'm trying to show is that not flying doesn't mean you can't go skiing. And listeners might know that in 2019, I founded Ski Flight Free. It's a campaign to encourage more people to take that option rather than flying. And I've covered this many times before, but if you fly, your travel represents 60 to 80% of the carbon cost of your ski holiday. And you can bring that right down by traveling by train or by driving an electric car. And I've driven out to the Alps in an EV a couple of times before. I did it twice in 2022. I did it for a third time last week when I was out in Courmayeur and Chamonix. The car was a BMW iX M60. I'm not like a car person, but this is a very high-spec vehicle. What's most relevant to me is the range. All the bells and whistles on the inside, were fantastic. It has a little like button where you can massage your back while you're driving, which when you're doing the whole journey on your own, was pretty good. But it's the charging along the way. I think most people who consider driving to the Alps might have an electric car already, but haven't driven out the Alps before, would be possibly having range anxiety because you're covering a lot of distance. And so it's the third time I've done it. First time was not an unmitigated success. The second time was very smooth. This time I had a bit of both. Day one was Brighton to Courmayeur. That's about 700 miles. I left Brighton in the morning at 6 a.m. and I got into Courmayeur at about 10:30 in the evening. So 9:30 UK time. 15 and a half hours in total. It was a long day. I did have to stop and charge four times. That varied between 15 minutes and 50 minutes, at the longest. I guess it depends what you like. For me, that wasn't really a problem. They're all in big service stations. I just got out my laptop, logged onto the Wi-Fi and did a bit of work while I was going. It could have been nicer to get there quicker, but one thing that is true between all vehicles, whether electric or diesel or petrol or whatever, is the faster you go, the worse your economy is. Initially when I was getting used to this car, I was driving at 80 because, the speed limit in France is like 130 kilometers an hour, about 80 miles an hour. So I just thought, I'll drive at 130 and it just whizzed straight through that battery. It was much, the sweet spot was basically 72 miles an hour. And for charging, I actually use the Ionity network all the way. And that's three reasons. There's a lot of the Ionity chargers. I've used them before, and I know that they're reliable and crucially they're fast. You know, if you don't have an EV, you're probably aware that they're different speeds you can charge a car. And the other thing is I've got the app on my phone. I don't want to go to some new charger. I saw, unfortunately, quite a few people doing that. They're standing there in the cold, trying to download an app, trying to stick their credit card details in. And I just don't want to do that. And the other thing, the Ionity has like a route planner on there. So you can just put in what type of car you got, where you're going to, from and to, and it will do all of that planning for you on their network along the way and tell you how long you need to stop, etc. So for me, it went pretty smoothly. I'm going to write up for Ski Flight Free. I'm writing an article for Snow Magazine later on in the autumn. If listeners want more advice on EVs in the Alps, there's an excellent page on the snow.co.uk website. Long-time listeners might recall owner Richard Sinclair has been on the podcast a couple of times talking about his electric vehicle experiences. I'll put a link in the show notes to that. Simon, Erin, do you know anyone who's driven out the Alps at all?
Yes, I do, Ian. I had some friends come out at Christmas New Year and it was smooth going out. I think they had to wait a little bit to get charge on the return journey, but it was the busiest return journey of the year, the Saturday after New Year. So that is a busy time for anyone.
I mean, okay, I have heard about these you know, issues that can crop up from time to time. People are queuing, etc. I did have to queue at one of the Ionity chargers. As it goes, it was only for about 3 minutes. I guess maybe I was lucky in that respect. I think the other thing I like about the Ionity ones is there's normally quite a big array. They normally have like a minimum of six and sometimes up to 16 at a time. What I would say is if you are driving an EV, you know, it's entirely possible, whatever your range is, obviously helps if the range of the vehicle is longer. It's not really at that stage yet where you can't plan. Like on the way back, I planned that journey really precisely. I looked at where I was to start off with, how many miles I had in the battery already, where I was going to get to, how long. I didn't actually rely on that Ionity route planner because I wanted to do it slightly differently to try and minimize the number of stops. Instead of, for me, it's not a problem to stop for 50 minutes or an hour at a time. I'd rather do it like that than have two 15-minute stops. So you still have to think about it. But, you know, the number of chargers that are being installed is going up a lot. Now, let's move on to my guest today, Erin. Ruanua, that's a new resort wear brand. I guess the first thing that strikes me is, did I pronounce the name correctly? And where does that name come from?
Yeah, of course. So yeah, we're a new brand, Ruanua. So the name is originally Irish. So it's because I'm Irish, of course. It stands, Rua means red and Nua means new, and it's like a new red. So the idea of the brand is that we're not reinventing the wheel in terms of ski wear, but we're bringing our own twist to it. We're revolutionizing it. So the traditional ski jacket was always a red jacket, like for ski patrol and ski instructors. And my first jacket that was a hand-me-down for my brothers was red and I hated it. So it was like a test to myself as well to design something that I absolutely loved with the color that I swore I would never, ever wear again.
You mentioned there, I think you use the word, you know, revolutionize ski wear. I mean, that's quite a bold statement. But before we come on to that, I wonder if I could just take you back a little bit. I mean, you said that your first jacket was a hand-me-down, but you are a former racer and ski instructor yourself, right?
Yeah, well, my first jacket was when I was a toddler. And I mean, my parents probably got it from someone else as well. So it's probably a double hand-me-down, but I guess that's sustainable. Yeah, so I was very fortunate that I skied my whole childhood. But then when I was in school and when I was in uni, I used to do ski racing, so mainly slalom. And then I was never the best in the world at it, but I just loved it so much. And then when I was 17, I became a ski instructor and I did that for a little bit as well. And then, yeah, all through school and uni.
And you did a ski season as well?
Yes, so I did a season in Saalbach, which was incredible. Saalbach is a longtime favourite resort of mine, and I used to go a lot as a teenager with my family. And yeah, I decided just to bite the bullet and do a season. So I was there last year, and it was incredible. I worked in a ski school, but I actually hadn't taught in years, so I worked in the ski rental of a ski school. But that was so much fun because I got to try out every ski, so that was a huge perk.
Excellent. Well, we mentioned Saarbach earlier because the World Championships are coming up over there. But prior to that, then I'm thinking you've also, you know, you've launched a new ski wear brand, but you've been working in that fashion industry for some time.
Yeah, exactly. So a huge passion of mine is obviously skiing, but another one is fashion. So when I finished uni, I decided to go into fashion buying, and I've been there for about 5.5 years, and coincidentally all the areas that I bought were like activewear, knitwear, so they're all very technical areas that are very handy for when you need to start a ski brand later down the road. But so yeah, I was working and I was doing outerwear buying for a few years, and it's quite technical and I really loved it. And then I was listening to a podcast by Deborah Meaden, and she was saying when she's looking for people to invest in, you know, I want someone who's uniquely positioned to do a job. And I thought, wow, like, who is this interested and passionate about skiing, but also knows the technical buying side of outerwear and jackets? So I thought, yeah, I guess that's me.
Right. And also that role gave you the experience of working with and dealing with Chinese suppliers?
Yes, exactly. When I decided to do this, I had one supplier in mind. So I had this supplier that I've been working with for over 2 years, and I just really loved their ways of working. I loved their communication and their make. And I thought, like, if I'm doing this, I want them on board. So and when we would be in supplier meetings with them, they would always be showing me like their cool product innovation. And I mean, we could never afford it. So they're always just trying to upsell me. And I was like, okay, it looks amazing, but I can't afford that. But then it gave me the knowledge of their product and capabilities. And I knew that they made ski wear for US and Canadian markets. So when I had the idea, I pitched it to them, and I'm very fortunate and lucky that they were happy to be on board. So it's really great that I know my supply base pretty well.
Right. And I guess a key part of that is the sustainability side of things, because I mean, you can explain this in more detail, but I think I'm right in saying that the Ruineur product is made out of a stock fabric that's been reused or would have been unused otherwise.
Yeah, so I think sustainability is such a buzzword at the moment, and it's definitely something that we strive to achieve. And you know, we're not perfect, but it's a work in progress. But a lot of people think sustainability is just recycled fabrics, and a lot of the time to get recycled fabrics, you actually have to commit to huge quantities, and producing huge quantities is inherently unsustainable. So we couldn't meet those quantities, and rather than just, okay, let's just leave it at that, we looked at, I knew what fabric composition I had. So we worked with the supplier, you know, what in this composition do you have and what stock colors? And we use stock fabric, and, you know, the dyeing and process of fabric is really harmful. And I know every year there's like different Pantones and different colors, but we decided, you know, does the customer even know what this season's Pantones are? Skiwear isn't that season, like it shouldn't be that trend driven. So we worked where we could to use stock color fabrics, and that's fabric that's already made, someone committed to it and then decided they didn't want it. So it's just in the corner of the factory being unused. So we worked with that. And yeah, because I think a big thing for sustainability is people just think it's recycling, but it's also reducing and reusing. So we're reusing that fabric, and then we're reducing by doing small quantities. So we built it as a capsule collection so that, look, I know the most sustainable thing is to just wear an old ski jacket, but a lot of women, and I'm sure men, like to, you know, switch up their outfit. So our range is mix and match. So we have it that, you know, one jacket goes with two different trousers. So say if you do want to wear loads of different things, you can buy less but get more outfits out of it. And then even in our future planning, we're building upon our existing range. Like, we don't want to be a jacket that you buy and wear for one season. We want you to have it for years and years to come. So maybe if you invested in one thing, you know, you can build on it.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't ever criticize anyone for buying something, because, you know, all items need to be bought at some point. But I think, you know, one of the points you're making there about, you know, sustainability. Also, when I was reading about it, you know, if listeners have listened to the podcast about equipment or jackets in particular that I've done with Al Morgan, we talk a lot about PFCs, and the waterproofing on your products are PFC free. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. PFC free. Yeah, PFC is like a harmful chemical, and it takes over 1,000 years to break down, and it's really harmful it can be harmful when you're wearing it, but particularly to the local communities when it's being processed into the water supply. So we have, it's completely PFC free, which is really good. And it's to 10,000 millimeters, which is
Also, rather than using synthetics, you're using down, like certified down.
Yes, so all our down is RDS, so it's responsibly down certified, which means that in the entire supply chain, it's certified that it's ethical. And yeah, it's so much better for so many reasons other than polyester, like as well as environmental. It's warmer, it's lighter, it's more compressible, so it's easier to pack. So yeah, there's a lot of benefits to it.
So that's how the product is made, what it's made from. But the actual design itself, I mean, I can see, listeners won't get this, but I guess the benefit of we're on video right now. It looks to me like on a rail just behind you, you've got some of the product there. What makes it different in terms of your design?
Yeah, I am. I'm in my stockroom office. So yeah, the design, again, like we're not reinventing the wheel, but as a customer and as a skier, I was always looking for something for ski jackets and ski wear that was, you know, fashionable but also functional. And that's where I just couldn't find anything. And a lot of my friends will be asking me as well. And look, I'm not saying that we're the only one on the market making fashionable ski wear that's functional, but a lot of the jackets out there, you know, they might be really fashionable, but they're not stretchy. You can't perform in them, where they're not breathable or they're not waterproof. They're only water resistant. So our idea is just getting a design that's fun, that's eye-catching, you know, and then it also has all the bells and whistles in terms of everything that I've wanted in a ski jacket or that I've had, it's in there. So it was really fun having that design process.
Oh, well, I'm going to be putting a link and a couple of images into the show notes so listeners can have a look for themselves. But what stage of the business are you at the moment? Like, when did you launch and how long have you been running? Is it retail or is it direct only?
Yeah, so I can't believe it's only our first season. It's been in the works for so long in the background, but now we launched in October and it's just been incredible. It's still such early days, but every month we're building on it and it's really just consistently building momentum. So at the moment it's all B2C, so it's just direct to consumers online. But we have some interest in some wholesalers next year. I'm not going to say names and jinx it, but hopefully we'll be in shops and maybe do some pop-ups next year. And then we also are going to a trade show in Grenoble next week. So if there's any wholesalers listening, I'll see you there.
Right. Okay. Well, that's excellent. It sounds like that progress is going really well. Having launched a business myself, I'm very mindful of the fact that there's no way around it. You've got to have a great product, but you've got to work incredibly hard as well to make that a success. So, well, I guess what might be useful just to finish off this stage just now then, Erin, is remind our listeners what the website URL is.
So it's www.ruanua.com or UANUA. And you can also find us on Instagram at Ruanua Official and on TikTok, Ruanua.
You're still on the show. It's not over yet. We're just going to move on to Simon just now. Simon's story is pretty different. I mean, from Ruanua, because this is a long running business. So, I mean, we've known each other for a long time. You know, when I was running Natives and we were events in Courchevel and things like this, we were doing stuff together on Boss to Boss and all sorts of different events, but you weren't running White Storm then. So when did White Storm come about? How did that happen?
So I guess my first winter experience was back in December 95, washing up in a hotel run by Ski Val in Courchevel. And Courchevel was very different then. We were actually talking about it last night with some friends. We reckon there was about, between Le Pra and 1850, about 1,000 British seasonaires, which was fantastic fun, absolute carnage at times. But, you know, it was a very different market to what it is now. And I worked with Ski Val for a couple of years. And then I went and worked on yachts for a couple of years. And then I wanted to come back and go skiing. So I ended up working for a company called Ski Hire, which we're running ski shops. Did that for 10 years. And then it ended up starting White Storm in December 2012.
Right, December 2012. So 12 years ago now, probably coming into your 13th season. We've discussed before, there's no other way to start a business other than putting in a lot of hard work. But I think if 13 years in, we can confidently say it's a success. Several shops around, you know, Courchevel, Mirabel now. Where was your first store?
The first store was in Courchevel 1850, Then we added Courchevel 1300. And then we added Mirabel Center. And then last year, we added Courchevel 1650. And alongside the four shops, we also do a delivery service in Courchevel, Mirabel, Latanya, and Val d'Isère and Teen.
I mean, you referred to how Courchevel has changed over the years. I mean, when I did my season in Courchevel in 1997, one of the après-ski activities we offered to guests was a pub crawl. You couldn't possibly do a pub crawl in 1850 now unless you wanted to drink champagne and eat caviar along the way. But we used to go across all of those ski bow club hotels from bar to bar and a couple of the other ones as well. That clientele has changed. There's way fewer chalets there now. So you've adjusted the business along the way to fit in with that?
Yes, you certainly couldn't do a pub crawl in Courchevel now. I think there's one pub. But we've certainly adjusted the business. We're dealing with we used to deal with a lot of tour operators, and that's how we got our business through the likes of Ski Vow, Super Travel, Scott Dunn. All those businesses have closed now. So we deal with some higher end private chalets and a lot of agents from Brazil, from the States, where they organize a ski rental for their clients through us direct. And of course, since, the late 90s, the internet has changed everything. So we get a lot of clients coming direct to us. So I estimate that probably 80% of our business is through our website and our partner store.
And you mentioned when you started, you started with the shop in 1850. Now you have several shops. I think when a business, starts to go well, that dealing with growth is a major challenge. Suddenly you've got, HR, you've got to recruit a lot more people, you've got way more overheads, etc. The challenges of growth that you have come across, how have you been able to handle that?
I'd say the most important thing is to have a really good team. When I started White Storm, I had Solène, a French lady who works with me, and she's been with me from day one. So we've grown the business together. And, whereas on day one, it was all hands on deck, we'd be working the shop 7 days a week. And it's about keeping your staff happy. We have a lot of return staff working for us. We try to give them 3 days off a week. So they're working between 35 and 40 hours. So they get a lot of ski time. And certainly this year, we found that by giving them the 3 days off each week, they're a lot better at work, as in they're a lot more productive and they're a lot happier. And the main thing we aim to thrive on is good customer service. That's why customers come back to us. And you can't provide good customer service unless your staff are happy. There's no point having miserable staff in the shop. So they've got to be happy.
That's definite, for sure. How many staff are you employing then?
21.
What about I hate to mention it, but I've got to say the B word, Brexit. What about Brexit? Did that change how you recruited your staff?
Yes and no. So you can still recruit British staff, and we still do. I'd probably say we're looking at about 50% British staff, maybe a bit more. You have to go through the permit and the visa process. It basically means you have to be more organized and have all the people you want to recruit organized by September, because the process takes 2-3 months. And the later you leave it, the longer it takes. But also, as the market's changed, we probably, out of those 21 staff, at least 65% of them speak French and English to a very good level. I'm probably the worst French speaker in the whole business, to be honest. You can still recruit British staff. It's just a little bit more difficult. And obviously, because the process takes longer and it's more expensive, it means basically we don't employ anyone under 22, because we can't afford to take the risk on an 18-year-old. Because although you can employ British staff, if you lose them mid-season, you can't replace them with British staff, because the process for the visa and permits is too long. So therefore, you can only recruit European passport holders mid-season if there's a problem, which there always is.
Yeah, and it helps if you have an Irish passport like Erin.
Yeah.
Another question in relation to, I guess, trends within ski hire. Listeners to the podcast know that we work with InSport Ski Hire, a massive ski hire company. And one of the biggest selling points for renting your skis rather than buying them is baggage fees. Baggage fees have gone up in a lot of years. Like, flights are still cheap on the face of things, but by the time you factor in all the other costs, suddenly it becomes a lot more expensive. Have you found that those increased baggage fees have helped you? They've pushed more people towards ski rental?
I'd say for sure. I mean, we used to work on a kind of formula that if you say you're renting to a chalet, we'd estimate that 50% of the guests would rent ski equipment from us on average, and they'd either rent from someone else or bring their own equipment. There's a lot less own equipment coming up because the time you've paid the baggage allowance and you've got your ski serviced at the end after a week, you're suddenly looking at a kind of 120 euros to bring your own skis out. So when you can rent for sometimes less than that, or sometimes, you know, 20 or 30 euros more and get this year's ski and have the opportunity to swap a ski during the week, yeah, we get a lot less people bringing their own equipment out. Boots, more people buy their own boots now and they bring out their boots, which is good because boots are the biggest pain.
literally and metaphorically for that, yes. One. That's brilliant, Simon. Thanks very much for that. And good to hear that there's snow on the way, because I imagine that, you know, as a ski hire company, you want your skiers to be out on good snow and not like hitting like those periods where you have rocks, you know, poking through, or sharks, as some people call them. That must be a nightmare period for you in a hire shop.
Yeah, we always like to have some extra pow, pow, pow.
Makes it easier. That's great, Simon. Thank you very much. Okay, cool. Well, we're going to segue from Courchevel. I was out there in December looking at the new Celia cable car, to Courmayeur. I particularly want to mention Courmayeur because I went there. I wanted to try the Skyway Monte Bianco lift. And that goes from Courmayeur at 1,300 metres up to Punta Heilbronn at 3,466 metres. It's basically going up, if you've been to Chamonix and gone up the Aiguille de Midi, it's kind of on the other side of that. It gives access to the Vallée Blanche. You could ski down the Vallée Blanche from there if you wanted to, down the Mer de Glace. So many stats about it. You know, it took 3 years to build. It cost 110 million euros. It was the most expensive cable car in the world at the time. And it is so impressive. I'm so glad that I did it. There are two cabins, one that goes from Courmayeur to the mid station. They take 80 people. They are circular and they rotate and they do a complete revolution on each segment. So it doesn't, sometimes, you know, with lifts that have great views, you find yourself rushing on because you want to try and get, you know, the best view at the front or whatever it is. But you're going to get a really good view wherever you stand on this. At the top, like a lot of these, you know, very high lifts. Incredible views, Dom de Géant, Grand Jarras. You can see the Matterhorn in the background, and you're very close to Monte Bianco or Mont Blanc, as most people know it, much closer than you get in the Aiguille de Midi. Some really brilliant museums in the mid station there as well, about the history of Punta Heilbronn and mountaineering. I recommend, if you want to do it, give yourself at least 3 hours. You can ski from there. I wouldn't do it without a guide. You know, it is skiing over a glacier in demanding off-piste backcountry terrain. But just go out there and take the trip. I thought it was fantastic. Have either of you two been on that lift?
No, but you really sold it to me. Now I want to.
No, I haven't, but it sounds great. Love a rotating lift.
So I highly recommend it. Courmayeur in general, you know, I enjoyed it there. I mentioned before about how the piste were very empty, meant you could go quite fast, which is fun. Lots of off-piste potential, but not really any good for me with the current snow conditions. I would say 3 to 4 days for, you know, advanced skiers, you know, intermediate or beginners could spend longer there. But so much character in that place, so much character, just in Italy in general. Really good mountain restaurants, just affordable, you know, cute smaller lifts. You know, I just really enjoyed spending some time in Italy again, and I've got a couple of other Italian trips coming up.
I'd like to say I really enjoy skiing Italy as well. We've been doing a kind of gentleman's trip there in January for the last 10 years, trying to do every resort in the Aosta Valley. I was in Champlut last week, and although lift system's quite old, the snow was really good and it was quiet, and you could really open up on some runs to get some nice speed without the fear of hitting someone, because it was hardly anyone there.
So that's exactly what John and I felt when we were skiing. Just the ability to really go fast and not worry. There aren't loads of skiers around. It's rare that you can get into that situation, those empty peaks. I think in Italy, yeah, it does get a bit busier. It was explained to me by the tourist, someone from the tourist board, that in Italy, instead of spreading out their school holidays over 3 weeks like they do in France, they all come in 1 week. Don't go in that week. Find out when it is and don't go then. I think it's Carnival week. But otherwise, just empty over there and, you know, so much character. Right, we're going to move towards the close now. I enjoy all feedback about the show. I'm really interested to know what you think, listener. So please do contact me on social at Ski Podcast or by email to skipodcast@gmail.com. I've had a few comments since the last episode. Jack Kelly just said, love the show. Costa said, the equipment specials have been very good this year. Al communicates the nuances of design very well. Interviews have been interesting. Showing the work that happens behind most people's 1 week ski holiday. Keep up the good work. So hopefully, Costa, this one has given you a bit of insight into that as well. And Helen Keast on Spotify, she said, really enjoyed episode 232 with Mark Smith. He is the man in C61, the train travel expert I interviewed recently. She says, I recently traveled by train to La Tuisière. It was such an easy resort to get to by train from Paris. The journey was definitely part of the holiday. One of the key points about traveling by train. Now, just a reminder to listeners, I still have some spare stickers if anyone wants any. And also, we have a WhatsApp community, I think it's called. I don't think it's a WhatsApp group. I'll put a link in the show notes if you want to join that. Basically, I share information in there ahead of it being shared anywhere else on social media, kind of inside information about the show, etc. There are now 244 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with, and 191 of those were listened to in the last week. There is so much to listen to in our back catalogue. Just go to theskipodcast.com, search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest in there. And in the last week, 57% of our listeners were in the UK, 16% in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide as Zambia, Mexico, and India. So if you like the podcast, there are three things you can do to help. Just follow us, subscribe, just look for that button now, press it. You can give us a review or leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can book your ski hire with InterSport Rent using the code SKIPODCAST or taking the link in the show notes. Now you can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at Ski Podcast. But for now, I'd like to thank my guest today, Erin. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been such a fun experience and lovely to meet you, Bith.
No problem. Best of luck continuing the business. And Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ian.
And I hope it continues to snow down at 1,000 metres and even lower. Finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.